and temporary shelter for battered women and children. Help women move forward with them.
Listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and you've got Living Writers today on the program. I'm so happy to have Dean Young here. Dean, welcome. Welcome to Living Writers.
Thank you. I'm glad to be counted among the living.
Yeah, you don't know how many people are, actually. They're like, well, thank goodness I still qualify for the program. I should say that we're taping this program. So right now in our world, it's the 17th of September, 2009. And Dean is in town, to read and also meeting with students at the University of Michigan, aren't you?
Yeah.
So you're here doing a lot of good work.
Missionary work?
Yeah, some poem missionary work.
Who's the savage and who's the missionary now? That's hard to figure out.
That's very kind of you to say. And I also want to say thanks to Reverend Andrew for being here today to engineer, make us sound good. And, I guess it's up to us now to say some things, right, Dean? I'll start with your biography, your most updated one.
Okay. That's a very exciting document.
Hold on to your hats, ladies and gents. Dean Young has published 10 books of poetry, recently Elegy on Toy Piano, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and Primitive Mentor. He has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, two from the National Endowment for the Arts, as well as an Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He's taught in the low residency MFA program at Warren Wilson College and was on the permanent faculty at the Iowa Writers Workshop until becoming the William Livingston Chair of Poetry at the University of Texas at Austin in 2008. A book on poetics, The Art of Recklessness, will be published in August 2010 from Grey Wolf Press. And Aaron was kind enough to send me a manuscript, you know, which is in the editing process there. So we're going to talk a little bit about that book too, and maybe hear some poems from Elegy on a Toy Piano and Primitive Mentor, Skid, Strike Anywhere.
Well, maybe we'll narrow it down more than that.
Yeah. Well, that's right, because we do want to have some conversation, not free-form poetry, one poem into another, right? So so Dean chose all the songs for today's program, and we started off with King Crimson.
You bet. Elephant Talk, great, great song. Sort of appropriate, too, for radio.
It is. I'm thinking I might try to use it for the lead song for Living Writers Always. I've been looking. Not paperback writer from the Beatles, so moving on.
You gotta listen to the whole song, too, because the lyrics are just terrific. But Adrian Belew plays this incredible like guitar riff that sounds like a screaming elephant.
And that could always end the show.
Yeah.
Just a little something to leave everyone.
Nothing like a screaming elephant to clear the room.
Exactly. Or that could be at the halfway point of the program. Well, let's talk a little bit about your backstory, because this short bio obviously doesn't say it all. When you were a wee lad, did you know you wanted to be a poet, Dean Young? What was...
Well, I didn't know if I wanted to be the poet Dean Young. I still don't know who that is, but I just started writing poems when I learned how to write. And, you know, those two activities, writing and writing a poem, were pretty much the same thing for a long time. And I don't think that's that unusual. I think a lot of people, when they're young, they write poems.
So when you were about 5 years old or so,
yeah.
or so, Okay, because I know you said third graders. Everyone's a natural poet until third grade, because you have that sense of wonder and.
Yeah, and your language facility is expanding greatly, but you still have a kind of loose and imaginative relationship to the world, and the referential power of language doesn't seem to be a limitation. It seems to be more of an incarnation, so that when you say things, those things happen, rather than things happen and then you have to come up with the words to describe them or refer to them, which that way of thinking means that language is perpetually falling short, as opposed to the other way, which is a somewhat magical, imaginative way of thinking, means that language is always in advance. It always occurs. To some extent, reality is perpetually trying to keep up with the imagination. So I started writing poems when I could, you know, when I was learning how to write, and I just didn't stop. Most people, I think, go through some sort of maturation process or sober up or something, and they just stop.
And feel shy about the poems themselves, or just get distracted by baseball or what?
Yeah, and, you know, for boys, there's a particular kind of a socialization. It doesn't happen so much with girls, because they, it's, you know, I don't know, it's really not my field of expertise.
Child development with Dean Young.
Yeah, not that
this
I
afternoon.
Have a field of expertise. But I know that there are, you know, what happens is socialization. And with that is, you know, the fear of being different, you know, the desire to become part of an identifiable part of a group, rather than be someone who is imagining the world as a, you know, in a playful relationship. You're trying to find a safe place to be.
And poems aren't necessarily safe then.
No. There's no way you can write poems without being a weirdo. There just isn't, because to some extent they are a product of whatever individuality, whatever strange inklings one has.
If they're good, or if it comes out, that's the way it's going to be, because everyone's peculiar.
Yeah. And the whole, I mean, if they're good, it's certainly, I mean, there's no real way of knowing if they're good. You certainly can't know that about your own work. You'll never know that. I mean, we can agree that there are poems by Yeats that are definitely good, and poems by Hopkins that are definitely good, and poems by Dickinson that are very, very good. But one's own work and one's contemporaries, one remains perpetually sort of unsure about.
And is that because it's too much part of the time, you're part of the time they're made, or that it's something that we can't quite understand what is lasting, and those others are lasting?
Well, that's interesting to say, because that assumes that lasting is a quality of the good.
It might just be marketing.
Yeah, you know, in canon formation, and certainly that has been under inspection for as long as since I started graduate school years and years ago. You know, what lasts is not necessarily, toxic waste lasts a long, long time.
Cockroaches. So,
yeah. Well, one has to admire the cockroach and the shark, because they've found something that really works.
That's genetic resilience. That's not necessarily, like, it's not as if we have 100-year-old cockroaches.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so who are the cockroaches and who are the sharks among poets? I mean, I suppose we could say Sappho is a cockroach, but actually, no.
Hey.
Terrible thing to say. I know. I didn't mean that to sound
I'm sure she was a lovely woman.
Yeah.
Very glamorous.
Yeah. But one must be, one must be suspicious of any form of validation that has anything to do with art, because it's all within a historical context. It's all within the context of individuals and various sort of cultural gusts that run through a particular time.
Cool. How do you reconcile then being the chair at the University of Texas at Austin then, Dean? Like, how does that fit in to that belief system, which I genuinely think that's what you believe.
Yeah, I think that it's extremely valuable to creative work is extremely valuable, and creative work that has to some extent no monetary, no capitalistic value. is extremely important. And I think of myself in my job. I got this job, and how I perform this job is primarily as a teacher and an advocate of poetry, not necessarily, not my own at all. You know, I don't really, I'm a practitioner the same way my students are a practitioner. So to some extent, we can share some of the same kind of dreads and strange little victories we have. Certainly, I've achieved some kind of success in terms of, all these books. And that's taken a certain, a lot of anxiety that young writers feel, anxiety of, accomplishment. And that's a real thing. The ego has to eat. But I feel that I can talk to students about that. But what we concentrate on is writing poems and the value of poetry and the value of using your imagination and the importance of the products of the inner life.
So maybe part of your vocation then also is, as like part of a protector, or not just like a guard, but not a sentry, but like a guard where you're actually responsible for, because as there's some great programs in this country, and I think Austin's one of them, and I think Michigan is, maybe
indeed.
I'm biased, and but so be it. But then there's this, because we're not going out and getting patrons necessarily, the artists of today. And so, but instead we have these programs or maybe the Guggenheim Foundation or the NEA. So maybe that's a way of.
Right. And well, the Guggenheim and the NEA, considering who they fund and how few people they can fund, is actually a minor concern. It's a real concern for young poets and young artists in general. How are they going to get health care? How are they going to, survive, pay their rent, lead a decent life? And you need money for that. But we have sort of invented, and they're primarily in universities, but they're also communities and private organizations, places where the arts are protected and nourished and assured a certain value. And I think that's incredibly important culturally. I don't think workshop is a kind of experience, creative writing workshop is a kind of experience that a young writer should have to survive. I don't believe in a kind of pedagogy which you go around the room and everybody crosses things out in a poem, and then the grand poopah, the teacher, says, well, yes, there's three words in this poem that really are interesting out of the 27, but they're not even in the right order. I believe that workshops should be basically not a petting zoo, but a nurturing place. And my primary goal as a teacher is that when a student leaves workshop, he or she is just as excited about poetry, their own and poetry in general, hopefully more than when they walked in.
Mm. Well, that seems, you've thought about that a lot then, Dean, because you've been at Iowa and the Warren Wilson, like we said.
Yeah,
so.
And I've taught for over 20 years, and I was a student too. And, as a student, I had some good teachers, and I also had the benefit of having what I felt to be very, very important negative examples.
And this was at Indiana University. So one of the, because the MFA programs have multiplied.
Right.
But Indiana is one of the old guard as
mm-hmm.
well. Okay.
Yeah. I was in the first class, first
That's,
MFA class.
It's in interesting
Indiana.
You said that the negative also helps, and it's helped your future students too.
Well, I hope so.
Well, we'll take a short break and we'll come back today on the program. Today we have Dean Young on Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm T. Hetzel, and you've got Living Writers. And today, so happy to have Dean Young here in the studio, the man himself.
In the flesh.
Exactly. Thank goodness, and alive. So Dean, you've been quoted as saying, this is probably always dangerous. You probably brace yourself. As you've been quoted as saying that that the process is the most important part of the poem, the making itself,
right,
rather than even necessarily the product.
Right.
What
is that?
Why do you say that?
Yeah. What does that mean? Well, I mean, I like to think of writing as an actual activity that one embeds oneself in, that one engages in. And it's in that activity that inspiration really happens. I don't believe that inspiration is some sort of separate entity that just whacks you when you're going down the street and then you go and write a poem. I believe that it's a process that you engage in. You sit down with, I don't know, whatever you write on. For me, it's a notebook with a pen, and I don't have anything in my mind. I have a completely empty mind. So a word will fly in, or a phrase will fly in, and then I'll just sort of start scribbling and playing with that, and sometimes something begins to emerge. And when something begins to emerge, that's when I begin to feel inspired, or whatever it is. That there is something that is not me, that I am a kind of conduit of. But even ridiculous as that sounds, as mystical, it has to do with making marks on a page to me, and those attendant ghostly sounds that those marks, they don't actually refer to sounds. They embody, or they direct one to. And those sounds set up a series of echoes or a series of situations that call for responses.
So it's about the sounds then as well. Like when you write something, you're also able, are you saying it aloud, Dean, or are you hearing something in your mind that,
I think that's what, you know, I don't usually, you know, talk to myself when I write. For one thing, I'm usually in a cafe. I could pretend to be on a cell phone the way everybody is now, but it's a sound that's in the head sometimes. And some of my poems will particularly use that sound as a guide, basically a kind of rhyming both in terms of parallels of images, but also an actual sonic rhyming. And others are more concerned with a kind of a forward energy, a kind of connectivity that is not necessarily a logical connectivity, but a sense that, like, I'm running across a creek on slippery stones, but it's a forward motion. And then the idea is to get somewhere, is to sort of feel a sense of arrival.
And is that necessarily a conclusion, or is it an arrival, and that just means that what you have is some material on the page that then you...
I worry about the word conclusion, because that seems that... I mean, it's helpful to think of a poem as an argument, but it's an argument as an experience. It's not necessarily an argument the way we normally think of, like, situational logic.
Or you wouldn't want to close something down.
Right, you know, and poems, you know, a word that's often used with poems is closure. And that has been, Lynn Hejinian wrote an essay, I think it's called Against Closure. Mm-hmm. And it's a smart essay, but you know, and I think she's right about closure, but poems have to end. That's one of the reasons we like poetry, is it comes to an end. I mean, that's one of the first things we do when we look at a poem, we read a poem, we're aware that it comes to an end. It's maybe its single identifying feature. The line comes to an end. The stanza comes to an end. Poems tell us that time is running out.
That's a big thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And nobody would ever want to read a poem that went on forever. You know, it's just
not
like,
even
it's a
Ovid.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have no idea where I was going with that. But
But now you're ending it.
Yeah, now I'm stopping it. And sometimes the best endings are abrupt.
And so, and you mentioned that you work in, you go to cafes. Is there something about the kinetic, the motion around you, or the dailiness of what's happening, or that you're there, but you're able to still be whatever, aware of the sounds and the moment that you're starting to have descend onto the page, or?
Yeah. There's something, you know, both the ability to be able to isolate oneself in one's head, and also the opportunity for distraction. You know, that there are things going, and you know, I'll pick up a phrase or something. Somebody will say something, and the language will then seem like something I can use.
And that fits with your love of surrealism. If indeed it is surrealism that you love,
I do indeed
Dean.
Love surrealism. Yes, I do.
Because if there's these pieces that are like of conversation floating by, that's in a moment where you can kind of take those and whatever pieces were floating by in your mind, add them together and see.
In Nadja by André Breton, he talks about signal events, and we all sort of know what signal events are, but we have a tendency to sort of think of signal events as being particular events which share the social values. It was a signal event when the Challenger blew up. But his notion is that signal events are much more mysterious. So that...
And subconscious?
Yeah, so that, you know, strange random meetings and things like that can become, you know, do become of utter importance because they can bring about a shift in consciousness.
And it's so serendipity... Yeah. Is so important.
Yeah.
And it's strange though, because poets, I don't know, seem to be more aware of the connectedness or see everything as connected in some ways. That's one of the kind of accusations that can be leveled at poets sometimes.
I know, everything rhymes.
Right. Well, you mentioned that, and that's in The Art of Recklessness as well. There's something, and also, I can't remember the exact, but I think someone passed away, and it's in one of the poems where you say, that's what becomes of us, is that we become, our lives become rhyme or something.
Huh.
Great. I know.
That sounds interesting.
It is. It's in your poem, and wow. I should have written down exactly which poem it was in if I was going to bring it up. Well, Dean, let's hear, you have new work with you today, new poems. May we hear one?
Yeah, this is I think this one rhymes a fair amount. Oh, it's one of these, it's an ode, and I started writing odes a few years ago when I had the realization that a poem could actually have a subject, and that the poem could be about that subject.
Because that's great, but why did you resist that for so long? Was it because were you resisting it, in fact, or was it that it hadn't necessarily occurred to your work that it did, even though you're reading other people's subject poems?
Yeah, I mean, I must have resisted it in some way. I mean, when you sit down and write a poem, you are already in an act of major defiance, whether you've drug it up to the conscious or not. So I probably was resisting that notion, but the natural, this process or whatever it is that I developed from the very beginning when I first started writing was one of a movement forward at all time of, I suppose you could tell sort of abandonment of the tyranny of subject, and that the real subject was always in front of you, that, you know, the most important things could not be approached directly. But, you know, I just started experimenting a few years ago with, you know, writing a poem that was, you know, called Ode to a Hangover, which was about a hangover. And, The sort of clarity and possibility of that allowed for a lot of play. I don't know, the poems may be boring, but there's nothing I can do about that. Well, there is. I just stopped writing them. But.
Okay. Well, that's not the epiphany of the day.
No.
Dean Young, let's hear the poem.
Okay, this is called Detachment Ode. The oak fell, it seemed, for no reason. No heavy snow. Not even a breeze. The woman looks at the man she's loved for years, but can't hear a word he says. Just a wasp strum at the screen, creak of a board that's walked on as he leaves. Ghost up from the basement, down from the attic, don't bother to wail, just wheeze and disappear. The sail turns to a dot on the horizon, a vanishing point vanishing into itself. Then the sky, the sea, you, me, a wash of splotch and line, abstract. Like a sneezing attack during sex, you don't know if you're coming or gone, shot into mist where Tristram forgets Isolde. The common near-death experience of hovering over loved ones gathered around the defunct self, poor bugs, and feeling not a twinge, less than the static shock of separating socks out of the dryer. Each talk wandered off from its tick. The house you lived in forever rubble now, hardly matters how. It might have crashed down loud as a baby's cry, but that baby's old and dying now, mind nearly a perfect cloud. It's okay. Anywhere can be your home. Just open your eyes underwater. It only stings a minute.
Thank you, Dean.
Sure.
Ode to Detachment.
Now, one of these things these ode poems did is allowed me to make lists. Lists of material that rhymed to some extent, both in terms of sonically, but also in terms of thematically, a list of things that concern detachment. And it's kind of fun because you can zigzag all over the place, even though for me it seems like the poems are very sort of, or compared to some of my other poems, very sort of located and continuous and united.
Yes, because I sometimes think of poems as like museums where there's one thing and then there's these different rooms where there's different, but you're in that particular museum of that moment.
Yeah.
And then, so that's maybe what these odes are. Your one subject poems.
Yeah.
Which take us everywhere still. Well, you're listening to Living Writers. Today on the program, Dean Young. I'm T. Hetzel, and we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and you've got Living Writers. Today, our Living Writer is Dean Young, here with a sheaf of poems, new poems. Also, his book, The Art of Recklessness, will be coming out with Gray Wolf Press, probably August 2010. That's what we're thinking now, maybe as a release date. And I thought it was funny in the back of that book, Dean, you said, and thanks to Charlie Baxter for, because he's a friend of the show, for talking you into doing the series. How did he twist your arm? Because this is a big deal, right? Because The Art of Recklessness is not a book of poems. It's your artistic philosophy.
Yeah, it's pretty much everything I thought up to that moment. It's a really sort of mixture of stuff. Basically, over the years, I'd given a lot of talks and written a lot of things down, given, you know, sort of mini lectures in my seminars. And Charlie, you know, and the press asked me to do this. And first they asked me to write a book about surrealism. And I didn't have a whole book about surrealism in me. And furthermore, I didn't think that I had enough to say about it to justify a book. I mean, there's a lot of that's already been written about surrealism.
Well, I printed out part of the Surrealist Manifesto by André Breton to bring in, I don't know, in case we wanted to
do a dramatic reading,
go toe-to-toe with the manifesto.
Yeah. It's a great document. I think it's the single most important artistic statement of the 20th century, but that's just me.
Maybe, you know what, you've just given me a great idea. Maybe we should do a dramatic reading sometime, Dean Young. Are you down for that with that manifesto? Okay.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of shouting.
Future Living Writers. Even if we have to do it over the phone, Dean, with you and Austin. You can still shout over the phone, right?
Of course. I do all the time. So, Charlie asked me if I wanted to do this, and I said, well, you know, I'll give it a shot, and, you know, I was very difficult for the editors to work with at Gray Wolf, just because I'm
a difficult person by nature.
Oh, maybe. I just wanted this book to be the book that I would write. So it wasn't going to be a collection of essays. It wasn't going to have what is a logical argument. It's not a piece of conventional literary criticism. I mean, there is criticism in there. But I just wanted it to be a kind of, oh, I don't know, maybe it's a tantrum, maybe it's a cheer, something that you know, pronounces my advocacy, talks about some things that I think are important, not only about poetry, but also about teaching, and sort of, you know, to really present my thought about poetry, about, you know, thinking about it and writing about it for over 20 years. Well, my whole life, really. And, you know, when I gave it to them, they were, you know, they had some suggestions, most of which I took. But then finally it was, you know, they were happy with it. But it's sort of an unidentifiable rant that just kind of goes to the end.
Well, it definitely seems like there's joy and proclamations in it.
Yeah, and goofiness. You know, and I wanted it to have some humor. I didn't want it to be dry. I didn't want it to seem like, you know, that this was the sort of findings of the expert. I mean, I couldn't do that if I wanted to. I don't think of myself as an expert in any way.
So in a way, it's almost like one of your poems, but blocks of prose instead, like those threads that you have, the different pieces.
Yeah.
And you have these different voices coming in because you have quotes by everyone, like Marianne Moore, Wallace Stevens, like all these different, so you're giving voice to these different, as if they're walking by in the cafe where you're making this.
Right, right.
Right?
They're like shouts periodically from...
More shouting.
Yeah. And you know, there actually are three poems in there, three of my poems that just sort of are wedged in there.
But why'd you do that?
Well, they were poems I felt like, I think it's three, were particularly about poetry. And it was a way of sort of, I don't know, keeping things kind of loose and a little bit off kilter and maybe a little bit unpredictable too.
So in a way you did give Gray Wolf that book of surrealism.
Yeah. I mean, certainly there's, you know, surrealism in terms of if there's a kind of overarching, or if some sort of house of thought occurs, surrealism is very, very important to it, both in terms of the sort of activeness of thought and making, and also the centrality of the imagination. It's the book, I think, one of the things it could be is a defense of the imagination. And the imagination doesn't get talked about very much. I almost never hear anybody describe a poet's work as imaginative anymore. And I talked about this little incident in the book where I mentioned that to some people. I was at Iowa, and some poets had come and read, and it was after the reading, we were having a drink, and I said, isn't it weird how nobody, talks about poetry being imaginative anymore? And one of the poets said, well, I don't want my poems to be thought of as imaginative. I want them to be thought of as real. And it was like that distinction between the imagination and reality. That she was hearing imaginary and not imaginative. And I think there's, I mean, it's hard to talk about the imagination. And certainly as a property of sort of evaluating a poem, to say one poem is more imaginative than another, I realize that could be very, very subjective and somewhat worthless. But I do believe it's a value that we need to do our best to articulate and honor, because for me it's central to the whole thing.
And it doesn't seem like the poem would really have a life if it wasn't from the it's impossible to really think that it would have a life without that imagination,
right,
being part of its.
And the imagination plays such an important role in how we can in our emotional health and our how we construct the world
for everyone,
yeah.
not just writers, not just artists, people who take that mantle.
Right.
But everyone.
Yeah.
And sometimes it seems like it is getting encouraged that it's squeezed out of people in some ways. Or let someone else do the imagining or the presenting of...
Right.
Moving images, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, and I think that has something to do with postmodernism, and it also has something to do with the exhaustion of our culture.
The exhaustion of our culture.
There's so many remakes and so many things that we're just, on television and in the movies... that are just redoing what has already been done. So there's a lack of faith, I think, in our possibility to actually create the new, or at least come upon things in a different way.
Well, I have to say that reading your poems makes me want to write poems, and
yeah.
I don't always feel that way. So they're good. They're poems that make you want to imagine your own.
I think that's a very high compliment. Thank you very much.
And I like how you say, maybe one day everyone will get up in the morning and write a poem. And I think part of that might be possible, and especially thinking about the art of recklessness, and because already on the short time we've been talking together, Dean,
uh-huh.
you've said play numerous times.
Yeah.
And I think that's the little gateway to walk through, where you might be able to write a poem every morning if you don't bring like this weight
yeah.
of what it's supposed to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I think it's very important to engage in the process as much as possible, because I know this is true of any writer. If you don't write for a while and then you get back writing again, what you write, you feel... You want it to be, it's obligated to be just fabulous. And because you haven't written for a while and you want something to look back at you and say you're not wasting your time. But maybe I'm saying it's easier to waste your time if you do it every day rather than save it up. Yeah, I like that idea.
I do too. Let's hear another poem, Dean.
Okay.
Unless you want to say more about it's easier to waste your time if you do it every day.
Oh, I have to think about that. Well, I do believe that our culture, certainly our planet, would be much better if people wasted more time.
Especially the Americans.
Oh, yeah.
I don't mean to make
I like the idea of bringing back the Sabbath and sort of without any sort of religious overtones. Because when I was a kid, on Sundays, none of the stores were open. And, you know, there's just no reason to get in your car.
We need more things for the spirit. Like, whatever, you know, maybe we need a new language for it so it's not weighted with people's particular religions, but whatever that spirit, whatever, like, makes this body actually alive, need some time for that.
Yeah, and I guess culturally, I mean, we had one of these great traumatic moments back in September 11th, and it was a real opportunity for this culture to sort of rethink itself and behave in a different way. And for about a week afterward, we definitely were behaving in a different way. And then, because our government was controlled by guerrillas, we went back to say, okay, you know, what we were supposed to, the first thing we were supposed to do is go out and shop.
And that's how they repackaged what those feelings, everybody, what they were acting like, they repackaged it as that, right? And so you couldn't think, oh, maybe there should be a shift in who we are.
Yeah, in our very notion. So we would go out and shop and bomb somebody. That's how we squandered that opportunity. Anyway, this is
all this lives.
Wallace Stevens is a poet that keeps coming into my head, and I love his poem "Rabbit King of Ghosts." It's just I just love that poem.
Do you know that one?
No, I'm not very good at memorizing or anything. But anyway, this is kind of a response to it, and it's called "Rabbit Plaything of Ghosts." How are the markets today? I found out from the reflection in a subway window I am a stuffed rabbit. Is that why no one tells me anything these days? I evolved from a block of wood, and now I have a heart of sawdust. My eyes never close. Jesus made me pink, like he made Wallace Stevens woesome and bubbly as a treasure chest in an aquarium. Verily, there are sad sacks everywhere. So it's no cakewalk just keeping my fur on. Cuteness is no protection against the dissecting impulses of your flung-down tribe. Cuddliness leads to evisceration. Larcenous secrets burning my flopsy-mopsy ears. But I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Sometimes being an unblinking stuffed bunny, you can see the tiny baby crying in each eye of the one who clutches you. How previously only monsters were her friends. How he fell from the treehouse. The reef always gone to someone else in the end. Soon enough, every bunny will be discharged to an attic, will be discarded to an attic trunk, while you zigzag beneath the lightning bolts of your worldly insurance adjustments. But in 50 or 50 million years, when you see me again, you'll dissolve like sugar in fire, like a rose petal in a beetle's gut.
Thank you, Dean Young. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back. You're listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today we've got Reverend Andrew on the engineer controls, Dean Young in the poet seat, and I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
Singarime, yeah, woo. I'm not the amai, I was singarime, yeah, woo.
back. You're listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, Dean Young is here. Dean, thanks so much for coming and talking with me today.
You bet. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. So, you're a funny man. Like, you're not really a reflection of a stuffed bunny with unblinking eyes.
Can we be sure?
Yeah, I know.
I guess that's a persona poem.
Exactly. That's a good one. Yeah. Is it a pressure to be known for your humor? Like, do you feel like, for God's sakes, leave me alone. Like, I'm not going to just be funny. Like, when you walk out into the world, or maybe when you come to Michigan, you know, for now, like, do you think?
Well, the instance of me being like a public person are pretty rare. It's not like, you know, I'm a poet and I'm not even that famous as a poet, so. Then who is? I don't care.
Okay, but who is? Like, I guess when you're saying that, just as like a, what do you mean?
My friend's name, Robert Haas, comes to mind. You know, and he's...
Friend of the show.
Yeah, he's a wonderful man, but he's sort of, he always kind of always has to be on. We've been driving someplace and people yell at him in cars and... And so, you know,
things though, no doubt.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But nonetheless, you know, that
not about his driving.
Yeah. He's obligated in a way to be a sort of public poet in a way that I am not, nor would I want to be. And I don't think he terribly wants to be either, even though he's, you know, marvelously good at it.
You use a quote of his actually to begin the art of recklessness.
That's from Berkeley Eclogues, right? You'll never catch a fish that way. You said one caught a fish that way. And that's an extraordinary poem, but that quote basically means that, you know, you can't rule anything out. And one of the ways that art has advanced or evolved, I mean, evolved seems like it, you know, we have to realize that evolution doesn't move towards a perfect state. It's not like, you know, it's not this notion of ladder of evolution ending up with humans. It's silly. But it evolves in terms of changing to its environment. Is poetry has done things that previous generations, you know, even contemporaries have said poetry can't do this. You know, and as soon as somebody,
what do you mean? Like what?
Well, as soon as somebody tells you not to do something, you should do it. And you know, we have the example of I always mix up my Johnsons. It was either Ben Johnson or Dr. Johnson saying about a poem that he received about a sheep disease that the subject could not be made poetic. And then, you know, of course, along comes the French. And we have no, you know, well, we there are a few subjects that we shy from in this country poetically, but they mainly have to do with race, and that has to do with our inability to articulate anything sensible about race in this country. But in general, you know, you could write about the most sort of traumatic, you know, sexually explicit, you know, whatever thing possible. Now we have, you know, no idea of that. So there are always things like that, and sometimes it's hard to see them. But once you see them, that's where you go.
So that's good.
Yeah.
So for when everyone gets up tomorrow morning, that can be the poem they write.
Right. Write a poem that something tells you in your mind that you're not supposed to write a poem that way.
And then email them all to Living Writers.
Yes.
And we'll...
Not to me.
Not to Dean Young, originator of idea. I also that Robert has his it almost sounds like it's an Eastern in nature, like the way, and that would make sense with some of his interests as well.
Absolutely.
So the humor of things and
the play,
cuz that's, I think that's, you can't separate that.
Yeah.
Right? Or can you? But you.
Well, it also has to do with subjects, I suppose, and movement and subjects. I've told this story before, but once I was asked, what, you know, after a reading in a Q&A session, which is always hilarious.
Your favorite part?
Yeah, I actually kind of like it. I actually like it more than the reading itself, because at least there's some sort of exchange going on. Mm-hmm. But somebody asked me why my poems were funny, and I said, Well, life is short. We often don't get what we want, and then we die. And the whole audience burst into laughter. So at that point, you know, it's like, I don't know what's funny and I don't know what isn't. You know, right. Sometimes what's funny is the truth said in a context or in a way that we're not expecting it. And the only way we laugh is recognition of the truth. I mean, I have a very silly and goofy streak in me. That's true. But also my experience in poetry readings, I just have no idea what people are going to laugh at and why they're laughing.
Oh, so are there moments where it just still surprises you when you're reading one of the poems?
Absolutely.
And there'll be a laugh? And because people laugh for so many different reasons. It's not just recognition, but it's, you know, unease or,
yeah.
or
yeah.
right, or yeah. that it's just so absurd that it is so funny or...
Yeah, and, you know, laughter is wonderful, but you can't think when you laugh. And so laughter absolves us of thinking. It is the body's way of striking at the mind, I think. And it's kind of beautiful. You know, laughter absolves us of mortality. It absolves us of guilt. It absolves us of conscience. It absolves us of history, I think. It's a wonderful, wonderful medicine.
Yeah, that is beautiful, what you just said. And I think but it also, if it wasn't like that release valve, or then we'd explode or implode,
yeah.
as beings, a lot sooner, right?
Yeah.
And for the poems themselves, if you don't, I mean, it seems like you're aware. You're very aware of like the shortness of life.
Right.
And that's a serious thought, because I mean, maybe we all want.
It's hard for us not to bust out laughing while we're talking about this.
Exactly, yeah. I know, and that's a serious thought. Heart, yeah. heart. Now we'll
yeah.
do some.
Yeah, exactly. What the anxiety I have now, though, is when people don't laugh. If I give a reading and nobody laughs the whole way through it, I think, oh, what's happened? There's no
way. Has that happened, though? I can't imagine.
Yeah, I've had, you know, extremely quiet audiences.
Are those grant-making groups? Or like,
I don't know. It's just, you know, I really don't like reading that much, and I swear I'm going to stop. It's embarrassing. It's weird. It's uncomfortable. It's such a strange social situation.
And if you don't feel like being on or being a performer of sorts, and that's a strange thing to also be with being a poet sometimes. Sometimes it seems natural, but sometimes you just want the poems to be in the world, and you don't want to be right out there huckstering with them.
Exactly. They're written in isolation. They're best understood in isolation. I suppose that's a relatively mean thing to say. I'm here to give a reading. But
you know. The rest of today's tour and... no. Why you feel that pretty strongly? Why?
Yeah. I'm old and tired. I don't know. No, I'm very suspicious of performance. I think performance is distracting. I'm interested primarily in what the language can do, not the way the language can be put over.
But what about the music of the language, which is more evident when it's allowed, when it's...
Yeah, yeah. That may be a limitation of my way of looking at things. But when I reread Hopkins, I'm very aware of the musical elements of the poem without hearing them. I think it's very, very important to hear them. I mean, he wanted his poems heard. He wanted his poems. I mean, he didn't want his poems performed. He wanted them sung.
Literally sung? Because I don't know that, Dean.
He orchestrated his poems. He conducted them. He invented a whole range of accentual marks which differentiated particular kind of speeds, particular kind of stresses.
That's interesting. And then you've had that project where you took technical manuals and you took pieces and made music out of something that was maybe absurd or terribly flat or
yeah. That for me was an interest of you know, experimenting with different kinds of contexts where the material, you take material from a decidedly unpoetic context and put it within the context of a poem, and seeing in which ways it reacts.
Yeah, and what kind of, because people always are saying like it's about attention. It's about, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what is it? Like, do you feel like with this forward movement of your work, your poems, do you feel like you're ever not, like, you know how some people say, even though the particulars of the poem are changing, but the poem, the meaning, or the, not the meaning, but the feeling of the poem is the same. What do you think about your work with that? What is the feeling of it?
Oh, I'm slower than I used to be. And a lot of that, I think, just has to do with age and my physical condition, that things are slowing down for me a little bit. And I think my poems are too. Whether or not that's good or bad, I don't know. It just is.
But I guess what I mean about the feeling of the poem is like that sometimes people are writing about loss even. So maybe the unknown concern of the poem, like, do you think that for you is shifting always or moving forward?
Well, it's definitely shifting. I don't know what forward would be.
Right.
It's definitely moving forward. Forward implies that it's getting better, and I don't know.
Not necessarily.
Yeah. 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 As one gets closer and closer to, the darkness at the end of the tunnel, it can't help but be reflected in some way.
Thank you, Dean Young.
A dreary end.
You've been listening. Not at all. You've been listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, we've had some good serious moments and some good laughs with poet Dean Young. Thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening. Until next time.
Good morning, WCBN FM Ann Arbor. You're tuned in to Crandall's Corner. Thanks so much for tuning in. We just heard a great show over here live in studio. Check out every week at 7 a.m. But we heard a great vinyl show today because it's the Vinyl-a-thon, the 24-hour records. All records for 24 hours. Happy Record Day. The WCBN will be having a booth later at the Ann Arbor District Library for their Record Day event. So pop by there as well. Support all the amazing local record stores in Ann Arbor. And yeah, thanks for tuning in. We're going to be doing an all vinyl show today. So our theme is pulling from the amazing collection we have here at WCBN. We're me starting off with some Woody Guthrie and sort of doing a random mashup of things from our wonderful collection here. Thanks for tuning in.
Rambling around your city, rambling around your town, I never see a friend I know as I go rambling around, boys, as I go rambling around. My sweetheart and my parents I left in my old hometown. I'm out to do the best I can.